Royal Observatory Greenwich, with various museums in England, observatories and museums in Germany, in France, and I was still not coming up with the pictures that I most desperately needed if the book was going to tell the story right, if the book was going to give the human dimension. You had to be able to see these people and what they were working with, and that is how I, in desperation, called Owen Gingrich at Harvard, and he said, "You're doing it wrong. What you do is you call up San Diego State University, and your job will be complete." And I knew of you all. I did, because I lived in Utah for 20 years, and you beat up on the University of Utah pretty regularly. And so I called. And, of course, that was the beginning of some of the happiest times in my life, because I met Lierhoff, who couldn't have been nicer, couldn't have been more helpful. That's why she's in the acknowledgments to the book, and not everybody that I corresponded with is there by any means. I can't begin to tell you how impressed I am with the collection, with the people who preside over that collection, with the fact that you have that collection, and one thing more, because as Ruth and as Lou and others were showing me around this collection in the last day and a half, and I haven't even scratched the surface, but as I was looking at it for many hours each day, they had to throw me out at the end of the day, time after time, they would open the book and say, "Look here, this is not just the Zinner collection. See, it says Friends of the Malcolm A. Love Library. You all have very significantly increased the scope and the value of that collection, and I would have come all the way from Baltimore to tell you that. I know there are a lot of people in this town who don't know of your collection, but anybody who is interested in early science knows and loves your collection. I'm happy to number myself as one." I'm sorry, I've taken up much too much time, but I had to tell you how important you all are and how much you've meant to me, and how much you're going to mean to me in the future, because now that I know about you, you'll never let it. I'm like a leech. Can I ask of Lynn Olson, who's been very, very helpful, if she would mind passing out some little handouts that Ruth and she have made possible, kind of a scorecard when Voyager 2 goes by Neptune in 12 more weeks. In the meantime, I'll use that to get the projector ready, tell you a few stories, show you a few slides. Be running back and forth just a little bit to turn the projector on, but let me see if I can begin by making some of the story, well, setting up the slides for their significance, because I'd like to tell you the story of a spacecraft, a Voyager 2. It is now almost 12 years into a 4.5 billion mile mission that has already carried that spacecraft by 3 planets and 48 of the 54 known moons of our solar system, of which that spacecraft itself has discovered 10. It has one planet to go. It will pass by Neptune on August 24th of this year. In doing so, it will have completed a grand tour of all four giant planets in our solar system. And yet, Voyager 2 is legally deaf, chronically arthritic, and just a touch senile. By all odds, this mission should never have happened, at least not in this century, probably not into the next century, and even then, it could not have been accomplished anywhere nearly as efficiently. It was made possible by insight, by spotting a rare opportunity, by seizing that opportunity despite many obstacles, by overcoming unbelievable difficulties, which have, in the conclusion, made Voyager 2 a better spacecraft than when it left home. The mission continues to revolutionize our knowledge of the outer solar system, yet this mission almost didn't happen 3 times. It owes its origin. There would be, in fact, no story to tell, probably, if it were not for a young man back in 1965 named Gary Flandreau. He was up the road a few miles doing summer internship at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And they put him to work on long-range feasibility studies. In short, nothing terribly practical. He was, in 1965, to look at outer planet missions. Remember, back in 1965, the longest space flight that any country had flown was Mariner 4, which had gone by Mars. That was the limit of how far spacecraft had flown. Because, after all, to go to outer planets, there were a number of problems. Equipment reliability, would the equipment even last long enough to get you there? Navigation, could you get anywhere close to the planet so you could see it better than telescopes on Earth? And finally, could you get the pictures and the data on the planet home? How about communication? Well, those were the problems. Mars, well, it took about 9 months to reach Mars. You could do that. We had done it. You could think about going to Jupiter. It was being thought about at the time. It would take 2 years to get to Jupiter. Saturn, that was 9 years. Nope, couldn't go there. The idea of going to Neptune or to Pluto, that was 40 years. That was ridiculous. How could you solve this long time travel problem? That was the core of the problem. How could you make it practical? You needed more speed. Well, you didn't have rockets in those days, and there were no rockets on the drawing boards that were going to be big enough, fast enough, powerful enough, and yet inexpensive enough to make such a mission practical. And if you couldn't increase the size of the rocket to give you greater speed, maybe you could shrink the size of the spacecraft. But there was a limit to how far you could do that and still have the spacecraft take pictures and contribute other information to make the flight worthwhile. Didn't seem like either of those avenues offered any great hope. Was there some other source of energy? And when Gary Flandreau began confronting that problem, that turned out to be the key. What other source of energy to get the spacecraft there might be available? Well, he knew, other space scientists knew, that comets are disturbed as they pass by planets, particularly the giant planets. Could you make use of that gravitational perturbation? Yes. Back in 1925, a German scientist, Walter Hohmann, had looked into that matter. In Italy, in 1956, Gaetano Arturo Crocco had looked at that problem, but more from the point of view of dropping a spacecraft in towards Venus and letting it then coast on in to Mercury. In other words, gravitational assist used by the inner planets. Even so, their work had been ignored because with the advent of the space age in 1957, reaching one planet was hard enough, much less trying to reach two. Others at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory that summer were looking at interplanet missions that used gravitational assist, but there were a lot of misunderstandings about a gravitational assist, about allowing a spacecraft to pass by a planet and letting that planet's gravity change the course and change the speed of the spacecraft so that it would go on to another planet. The first misconception was, yes, anybody could see that the spacecraft coming close to the planet would increase its speed, but would it not lose that speed as it tried to drift away? So you might gain a little bit in terms of the speed of passage, but you wouldn't gain very much in the long run. But there was a flaw in that thinking. Gary Flandreau spotted it, and quickly thereafter his superiors noted it as well. And that is that the planet, while it's having the spacecraft catch up with it, is also moving around the sun. And so when the spacecraft goes by the planet, it actually is draining a little bit of that planet's energy. And so the spacecraft comes out of that encounter, if it's catching up from behind, it comes out of that encounter with more energy, more speed than it had before. Ah, well, people would say, even if there was some net increase in speed, you have to go all the way to Jupiter and then use Jupiter to get to Saturn? Why, you've gone way out of your way. So you end up increasing your time en route anyway. Gary Flandreau was looking into that. He started with the idea of Jupiter as the key energy contributor. After all, it is by far the largest of the planets. He was looking at Earth to Jupiter with a gravitational assist to Saturn, the Earth-Jupiter-Saturn trajectory. And he found that late in the 1970s, there would be the positioning of Jupiter that would allow for that kind of gravitational assist. It was at that moment that he noted something else that no one else had yet seen, that in the early 1980s, the planets on beyond Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, would be in alignment as well, so that a spacecraft that went by Saturn could go on out to Uranus, use Uranus for yet another gravitational assist, and go on to Neptune. And that such a possibility happens only once every 175 years. It was a rare opportunity, and the launch window opened in 1977, only 12 years away, and would close within a year or two after that. A very rare opportunity. He never, he said, felt quite so much an exhilaration. And then very quickly, within a matter of minutes, depression, realizing that the American space program was at that point still moving fitfully forward, still with no plan for the future. Sound familiar? Still don't have any grand plan for our future, unfortunately. He doubted that there would be the commitment in America to get the job done. Nevertheless, he reported it and his excitement and the fact that either the opportunity was seized or it could never in our lifetimes or for more than a century and a half be gathered in again. There were many naysayers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, but his immediate boss, Joe Cutting, thought it was amazing, and they called in a Caltech professor who immediately pronounced it the thing to do. The next day after that meeting, Jet Propulsion Laboratory issued a news release about the discovery of the gravitational assist trajectory and how it could be used to reach the outer planets. That was the origin not only of what we now call Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, but even of the mission that preceded it, the Pioneer 11. There were some people in the community who took umbrage at this. They formed the Pasadena Society for the Preservation of the Orbit of Jupiter, realizing that as the spacecraft passed Jupiter, Jupiter would move inward by a millionth of a millimeter. Next stop for this very large-scale plan was Congress. What was being proposed to Congress was a very ambitious, almost billion-dollar mission. There would be two major large spacecraft. One would go to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. The other would go to Jupiter, Saturn, and Pluto. You couldn't get Pluto into that four-planet mission. In 1971, in that mission, by the way, at each stage along the way, the spacecraft would drop a probe into the atmosphere of that giant planet. In 1971, Congress killed the mission. That was the second time it almost didn't happen. But in the summer of 1972, with the wails of scientists in their ears, they appropriated $360 million to build two smaller spacecraft, Mariner-class spacecraft, like the one that had gone by Mars, for a four-year mission that would use a gravity assist at Jupiter to send the two space probes onto Saturn. Jupiter, Saturn only, the Grand Tour mission conceived by Flandreau, was dead. Almost, but not quite. Because as the spacecraft were built, as time drew near for them to be launched, the scientists and the engineers took one last fond look at the Grand Tour. They had four primary objectives. Jupiter, with its innermost large moon, Io, which had long been a mystery, and Saturn, with its largest moon, Titan, which appeared to have an atmosphere. They wanted those four targets taken care of. Was it possible to do that and still have a Grand Tour mission? Well, if you took care of Jupiter and Io, then by passing close to Io, you would get to Saturn too soon to go on a gravitational assist to Uranus. Wouldn't work. If you got to Saturn so that you could be diverted to Titan, passing by Titan would send you in the wrong direction for Uranus. But if Voyager 1, the first spacecraft to reach Jupiter, gave up a hope for a Grand Tour, it could go close by Jupiter and Io, close by Saturn and Titan, leaving Voyager 2 in a backup position, in case anything went wrong with Voyager 1, allowing Voyager 2 to stay in reserve for the Grand Tour. The Grand Tour, then, was just a contingency plan, a hope, a dream, a long shot. Thank you. That'd be great. Oh, and let's see, I think I have to... Okay. This is what happened on August 20th, 1977. Almost 12 years ago now. Voyager 2 left the Earth. Just beyond the Earth, it deployed the Voyager space probe. There it is with its cameras and other sensing gear. And up at the top, the big white dish for radio communication with the Earth. Its partner, Voyager 1, was actually launched 2 weeks later, but on a faster trajectory so that it got to Jupiter first. And Voyager 1 succeeded very impressively at Jupiter. This is about what you would see at your Laguna Observatory of Jupiter under very favorable conditions. There's Jupiter with its bands, with its great red spot, about two or three times the size of the Earth. Voyager 1 changed a lot of our impressions of Jupiter. Now it could be seen to look like this. You could see all those storms, all those clouds, all that banding in much sharper detail, much greater color. In this picture, you see two of the 16 known moons of Jupiter. You see one right over the face of Jupiter, reddish in color. That's Io. And then off to the right, you can see Europa, whitish in color. Both of those moons about the same size as the Earth's moon. So you get some idea of size of Jupiter. There you see off to the left the great red spot, measuring in this picture more than 16,000 miles across, more than twice the size of Earth. So you have a much better knowledge because of Voyager 1 and 2 of the atmosphere of this largest of worlds in our solar system, almost looking like a piece of modern art, very beautiful indeed. The great red spot, a giant hurricane-like storm, and the white ovals, also storms, but just somewhat smaller in size. Winds blowing along at 350 miles per hour. To many people's surprise, the Voyagers discovered that Jupiter has a ring, a very faint, dusty ring. You can never see it with telescopes from the Earth. Looking back, you could see the sunlight filtering through that ring from Voyager 1. Of course, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 got remarkable pictures of the large moons, four large moons of Jupiter. This is the largest of, this is the outermost of the large moons. This is Callisto, absolutely saturated with craters. Not much has happened there in the last 4.5 billion years. If a comet or an asteroid strikes that moon today, there'll be no net increase in craters. The new crater will simply erase older craters that have lain there. Here is the largest of all the moons in our solar system, more than half again the diameter of our earthly moon. This is Ganymede. And Ganymede had a surface somewhat different. Yes, there were lots of craters there, but now there were wrinkles on the surface. Mile-high, half-mile-high grooves and ridges that indicate tectonic motion. The surface of this planet was, in its early days, in turbulent motion pretty clearly. Even stranger was a still inner moon, Europa, and here's a picture of that. It looked like a cracked billiard ball, and yet these cracks were lying right in the ground. There's almost no surface relief at all. This is the smoothest of all the worlds in our solar system. Close up, looks like this. As if the surface is primarily frozen water, and the surface has been cracked, liquid water has flowed to the surface briefly and has frozen again. Some people have even suggested that there might be an ocean of liquid water underneath the frozen surface. Arthur C. Clarke even suggested that there might be life beneath the frozen surface of this moon. But as spectacular as these moons were, the most spectacular of the worlds that Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 saw was this one, Io, that innermost of the large moons of Jupiter, a little larger than our moon. And as one scientist said on first looking at this picture, well, I've seen better looking pizzas. And of course, as you know, what they discovered was that this is the geologically most active of all worlds in our solar system, with a number of active volcanoes as both of these space probes flew by. In fact, in the upper part along the limb of the moon, you see one of these volcanoes spewing lava, or spewing sulfur primarily, to an altitude of more than 100 miles. Voyager 1 passed Jupiter in fine form. The grand tour for Voyager 2 was still a possibility. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 headed on toward Saturn. This is a picture of Saturn, as you would see it with one of your telescopes. Very good telescopic view, but not nearly what Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 could see of Saturn. What an improvement, and what an amazing world. A computer-enhanced picture of the atmosphere of Saturn showed lots of banding, not quite as distinct as on Jupiter, but winds even higher, winds exceeding 1,000 miles an hour. Storms like those on Jupiter, but just not as large. And of course, examining the rings of Saturn, it was clear now that the rings of Saturn were actually thousands, tens of thousands of ringlets. Voyager 1 took a good look at Titan. That was another of the prime objectives. Couldn't see the surface. It was shrouded in an atmosphere primarily of nitrogen. Here was another world at last besides the Earth, whose atmosphere is primarily nitrogen. And almost unbelievably, a nitrogen atmosphere that had greater surface pressure by almost a factor of 2 than the Earth. It wasn't only, however, Titan that had surprises. Other moons, like this one, like Mimas, that showed evidence of a surface that was not just simply beaten by asteroids and comets over the centuries and millennia, but instead that had been active in its own right due to perhaps the gravity of Jupiter and other moons, or in this case Saturn and other moons, or due to internal radioactive heating. Voyager 1 then succeeded greatly at Saturn and at Titan. The grand tour now loomed large. On August 25th, 1981, Voyager 2 cleared Saturn on course. The grand tour was on. This time, however, threatened by problems on the spacecraft itself. Remember that I said that the spacecraft is legally deaf, chronically arthritic, and just a touch senile. Shortly after it was launched from Earth, a computer memory chip failed, and the computer lost about 3% of its workable memory. The solution was to work around it. It was a problem. All of the computer was needed, but it was a problem that could be worked around. The arthritis was another problem indeed. The spacecraft had a scan platform for its camera and for other directional instruments. Basically, as it flew by a target, it would pan to look at that target, and of course it would have to acquire the target first. As the spacecraft, Voyager 2, flew by Saturn, that pointing mechanism, the scan platform, seized up. It wouldn't run anymore. Eventually they got it running again, but they could not run it at high speed, and they were always very scared of running it at all. If you lost pictures, you could not regain them. So they had a solution to that problem. They, instead of moving the scan platform, they rolled the entire spacecraft. A pretty good trick, considering that when the spacecraft went by Uranus, it was going at 20 times the speed of a high-powered rifle bullet. It was going more than 56,000 miles an hour. Plus, there were other problems, because any motion at all aboard the spacecraft causes motion aboard the spacecraft itself, the action-reaction that Newton called our attention to several centuries ago. For instance, here you have a tape recorder to record the scientific data. The tape recorder starts in order to take in some of that data, say some of the photography. When the tape starts, the spacecraft begins to turn in the opposite direction. When the tape recorder stops, the spacecraft turns in the opposite direction. And so they had to develop a way of firing tiny bursts of propellant to counteract that little bit of action and reaction aboard the craft. They solved these problems. But the most serious of all the problems was a deafness that the spacecraft had developed. a real potential showstopper. 7.5 months after launch, before it ever got to Jupiter, there was a power surge aboard the spacecraft. It lost its primary radio, and its backup radio lost almost all of its tuning capability. The radio had been able to scan 100,000 hertz looking for the signal and lock onto that signal.